So open up an opportunity for anybody who has questions.
We'll pass the microphone around if you raise your hand. Then couldn't best, we'll bring the microphones around.
I don't know if it's a question, but I see what you're saying about the hindrances. But it seems like that's everything I called my life. Just all these stories are coming up and ill will that you're speaking about. And yeah, just looking at it and trying to stay on the breath, but it's like, no, don't do that. Just go to sleep or crunch your shoulders or something like that. So you're just saying just keep on working at it and it just gets used to focusing?
Excuse me. So that the... Yeah, sometimes when we first start actually trying to train the mind and investigating it, that feeling is a bit overwhelming in the sense of, wow, that's all my life is. the reality is not quite like that at all. And there's we have all these various options of bringing attention and awareness, and even if it seems very fleeting at the beginning, it's something that we can be building on. The cultivation of a direct lifting up of loving kindness or compassion, those are very ordinary meditations, in the sense they're very common meditations, that one clearly focusing on those very wholesome mental states and qualities. One can be directing attention to virtue and restraint and making it conscious, and generosity. All of these are very wholesome and positive mental states and mental qualities that we can be encouraging, and those start to gain traction in the mind, and we're able to replace those unskillful tendencies that are hindrances with something that is kind of uplifting and brightening for the mind. That's why it's that sense of cultivation and development as a word. You were cultivating and developing those wholesome and skillful mental states that actually support our well-being and inner tranquility.
Thanks.
Folk, please speak closer to the mic. Okay.
One minute.
Hi. Hello. I just have a question about secular Buddhism. What's your view on how...
Please hold the microphone closer to your mouth. Thank you.
Can you hear me?
I can, if you keep speaking like that.
Well, basically, I just wonder what you think about the idea of secular Buddhism, because earlier you said something about bhavana and versus meditation. And meditation is not a useful translation. So I know that secular Buddhism is kind of popular at the moment, especially in Europe, so I was wondering if you think it's useful or not.
Well, I mean, Anything is useful if it's picking up the actual teachings of the Buddha and applying it in a skillful way, so that and I think the idea of making that kind of distinction of secular Buddhism as if it's different from some other kind of Buddhism, I don't know that that's so useful, because I think what we want to be doing is picking up the teachings of the Buddha and realizing that the Buddha is addressing the human condition. And so finding ways to apply the teachings that address that human condition of suffering. The reality is that in a traditional Buddhist culture, Buddhism is applied in all sorts of different ways and within the culture, within the society, and it doesn't call itself something different than Buddhism. So I think in the West, it might be a bit confusing to use that term, secular Buddhism. I think what they're trying to do is trying to make Buddhism more palatable. I think the Buddha's teachings are if you're addressing the human condition skillfully and giving people the tools to apply it at whatever level and area of interest that they have, then the Buddha's teachings are incredibly flexible, applicable, so that certainly I have contact with people in America who are doing things like bringing Buddhist mindfulness practice, Buddhist teachings into education, areas of education. And it's just basically the Buddhist teachings that are then adapted and applied in a way that is useful within that setting and that area. I guess I have an issue with the idea of secular Buddhism being something different. I think it does a disservice to the teachings, and that the and it makes it a bit narrower, which I think is unfortunate. I think the Buddhist teachings are easily translatable into whatever situation one finds oneself, because human beings are always finding ways to create suffering, and the opportunity to find those skillful means that address that situation is available. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does. No, I was just asking because you spend time with Ajahn Buddhadasa, and to some people his teaching is quite secular in a way that he doesn't really talk much about reincarnation or supernatural and things like that.
Put the mic straight up your mouth,
And
put the microphone by your mouth. Thank you.
Did you get what I was saying earlier?
No, I missed it.
Okay. Well, I ask you because you spent some time with Ajahn Buddhadasa, and he and his teaching, some people call it secular because he didn't really focus on supernatural, pretty much similar to Ajahn Chah, but this way of thinking of may out gateway in gam, may out chat ni chat na, that kind of thinking.
Some people consider
that secular. That's why I'm asking.
I doubt that Ajahn Buddhadasa did, which is maybe a better better standard to gauge it by. You know, I think Ajahn Buddhadasa just felt that he was bringing the Buddhist teachings to people so that they could use it. I think Ajahn Chah, very similar. So that, if you recognize the value of the teachings and learn how to apply it, in whatever way one can, then I don't think it's helpful to divide it into a, you know, secular Buddhism, because secular actually is a narrow application, a narrow definition. So I don't. I don't think it's helpful.
Are there any other questions?
Ajahn, would you please talk a little bit about contemplation in meditation? You mentioned earlier about using methods, using different methods, and my understanding is they help you to calm the mind. How does one get into the state of contemplation, whether it's about anicca, dukkha, or anything, really? How, without disturbing that calm state of mind, how do you ease into that state of...
This is part of the cultivation of mindfulness and what's called clear comprehension as one is developing the attention, developing the focus and settling of the mind. It's important that the mind, and this is where that aspect of the kind of malleable, luminous, workable. Part of that malleable and workable quality is that the mind is ready to both, it's able to keep settling, but then it's malleable and agile enough to reflect on the nature of the experience so that it isn't, you know, sometimes it'll fall into those categories of, okay, anicca, dukkha, anatta, of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self. But it's not a mechanical plunking it into that kind of, putting the label on it and, trying to just, you know, say it over and over again, or hit the defilements over the head with, oh, this impermanent, that's not contemplation. Sort of really sort of allowing the mind to start to look at it from the perspective of, oh, look at that. That's shifting and changing. Oh, look at that. That's really, wow, I really got caught by that. So there's this, the kind of inner dialogue, and it's important to give some space to that dialogue to reflect or to recognize that quality of that experience of saying, oh, wow, that really doesn't belong to me. Now, why did I take that so seriously? that's really not mine at all. Why did I pick it up? So that kind of pursuing it like that. So it's held a bit more lightly. And then tuning into the quality of the mind where, okay, the mind is still, like it enhances the stability and clarity so that one reflecting on the experience or contemplating it, using the thought process, but it's not stirring up the mind, it's not agitating the mind, it's actually helping the mind to remember, because it's important the word that we call mindfulness in Pali is sati, and sati, its root is in memory, so it's more like recollection. So that recollection, that remembering what we're doing it for, and putting things in a context. So and the context, of course, is always freedom from suffering. And sometimes the stillness of the mind is more important, and sometimes the reflection is more important. But it's sort of a part of the spectrum of how we apply our attention and recollection as we're working with the meditation object, the experience of the, say, of the body and of the mind, and when the mind starts to, we lose the plot and get swept up in something, or we sink and fall into dullness, that recollecting, that remembering, and sometimes to do that we need to use the thought process to contemplate, okay, what's the nature of this experience, so that one can, because that the quality of interest and motivation is really important. There's a set of teachings that the Buddha gives that are called the four bases of success, of spiritual success. And the first quality is chanda, which is another word for desire. But it's desire in its positive application. So it's more like interest, motivation. So we need to be able to bring up that interest and motivation, kind of desire, in order to to keep on track, and that can be expressed in those thoughts of contemplation, of recollection, of investigation, that help. And then when the mind starts to maybe get a bit too wound up, okay, just come back to the breath, settle. And so you're always tuning in and trying to watch that balance.
Yeah. Like you said, that you have to adjust and think about contemplating. But in your life, in your working time, how can you do that?
Huh?
Like okay, when I'm sitting here, I can do that, like contemplating, thinking, and adjusting the mind. Mm-hmm. But in our working time, mm-hmm. can we still do that?
Well, yeah. In the same way that you bring mindfulness to the to the thing, to the experience that you're having, and actually, I remember somebody asking Ajahn Chah that same question. You know, how do we, you know, it's okay to, you know, you're in formal meditation and you know, we're able to do that. And what about in daily life and contact with the world? And Ajahn Chah says, well, in daily life in contact with the world, do you still breathe? You know, so that you've got the breath, and also that, in the sense that there's this, if you place an importance, in the same way you wouldn't forget to breathe, because it's essential. And when a commitment to truth and to peacefulness and clarity, it has that same, you have that same commitment, then it's natural that you lift that up, you work at that, because it's a life without contemplation or clarity or stability of heart is like just like stopping breathing. I mean, you just sort of die. So that in the same way you physically die, and just sort of, you know, really spiritually cutting yourself off from the opportunity to be peaceful and establish clarity and well-being. Why would one do that? It has to become, the more clear you come, reflect on that, contemplate, then you just don't want to just relinquish the mind to one's habits and the conditioning of the world around one.
Could you give us some examples, like in this situation right now in Bangkok? Like, there's a lot of news and many things that are giving people kind of a little bit crazy. There are several information that are like kind of divided into different, and when you see the news and you feel sometimes upset, sometimes angry, sometimes
why? Well, that's exactly it. I mean, if just by filling the mind with useless information, which is mostly what the news is, then you experience all sorts of confusion. So why even bother? I mean, it's a conscious choice to go and, turn the television on, turn your computer on, go and check the, your time, there's just not enough time to waste by doing that. Or the conversations that you engage in. It's like, since I've come here, I arrived on a couple weeks ago, and people keep trying to engage me about the political situation. And sort of like, I don't care. You know, not in the sense that I don't think it's serious or that it's not a problem, but I don't care in the sense that I don't want to be getting involved in whatever side people are working themselves up about. Because the problem is much deeper than that. And I think we have to pay attention to the deeper problem. And the deeper problem both on the human condition-wise and the deeper problem even politically. Because it's so that I think that's much more important, to sift through the stuff that just agitates the mind, come back to the essentials. Bill is back there.
Thank you, Ajahn. I have a question about pleasure. I find I do need some pleasures, even though they don't last. Things like fine arts and being in nature. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, how did you manage as a monk in your early years at Ajahn Chah's monastery, where there's almost no pleasure? You had poor food and You had to get up early in the morning. You had to work very hard all day long. Mm-hmm. There's no music, no entertainment, really nothing that us lay people would consider pleasure. How did you manage and just keep going over the years until the present?
Well, that's a really important question because, you know, there's... it is essential that we experience pleasure, that we experience happiness. And the Buddha is not actually against it. You know, the whole point of freedom from suffering is so that one can be experience something that we're actually hardwired to be drawn to. We're drawn to pleasure. It feels a lot better than suffering. So that for myself, just the pleasure of simplicity, the pleasure of being in nature, the pleasure of being around virtuous beings who are incredible examples for the world, the pleasure of seeing goodness in other human beings. I mean, that's one of the extraordinary perks of being a monk is that everybody tries to be good around you. it's really pleasurable to see the goodness of the human beings, the human condition. Those aren't the same pleasures of gratification and entertainment, but they're very real pleasure. And it's important, say, like for myself or for any monastic, in order to stick with it, to stay with it, that they do find it pleasurable. It's obvious that there are difficulties, and not being used to austerity or having to face the frustrations of having a mind that doesn't comply with our wishes, but to be able to pay attention to ways of how to experience pleasure, happiness. And that's it's actually, like in reading the suttas, that's a really important turning point for the Buddha, for the Bodhisattva, in his quest for enlightenment. There's a discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya where the Buddha is recounting his experience of this austerity and extreme ascetic practices and basically how miserable he was, and then coming to a point where he sitting quietly, the mind being peaceful at some point, and then remembering the happiness and pleasure that he felt as a young boy sitting in meditation under the rose apple tree. And it's a very well known story in Buddhism. But it's interesting how the Buddha reflects on it in that sense. Because he poses a question. There's this, because he remembers this happiness. And then he's thinking, why am I afraid of that happiness? why am I afraid of that happiness? That happiness is utterly wholesome and not censurable by the wise. You know, why am I afraid of it? Maybe that's part of the path. And then he has this insight, you know, and kind of excitement. It is the path. And that's where he relinquished his austerities, extreme austerities, and then started eating again. And that, but that quality of pleasure that comes from a relinquishing of the hindrances. You know, and it's interesting when you like when the Buddha describes the developing of meditation, describing the different types of pleasure and well-being, delight that the mind experiences in relinquishing the hindrances, and then the first jhana is based on the pleasure born of seclusion. So that when we experience pleasure in seclusion, solitude, not being overly stimulated and engaged with things, there's a pleasure there. Or the second jhana is pleasure born of the unification of the mind. When the mind and the heart really unify and aren't at odds with each other internally, it's incredible pleasure arises. Or the Buddha talks of the pleasure and happiness that arises from living within the bounds of virtue. And it's that the pleasure of blamelessness, like the happiness of blamelessness and non-remorse, is being able to live in that way. You know, and certainly for myself, that's the, you know, as a monk, and yeah, I can look back on 40 years of living in a way where, yeah, I don't have to feel remorseful or regret about anything. Yeah, that's, and oftentimes we don't really think of how those things can be pleasurable. But it is. It's a very important basis of happiness. And of course the happiness of just seeing and having that conviction was, wow, that's really the way things are. This is true. So that wisdom and discernment that sees and says, well, that's really the true nature of things. And it's a tremendous source of happiness. Okay, we're at 5:30.
Just out of curiosity, a show of hands of how many people plan to come back for 6:30 Dhamma talk? Most hands going up? Okay, that's a good sign. Tell your friends. So we'll start promptly at 6:30, and this is a good time to use the bathroom, get some food, or whatever you need to do. So we'll have a 1-hour break.
We'll have a break, come back, see you at 6:30.
So we can bow together to the Triple Gem and to Venerable Ajahn in gratitude for the teachings today.